This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery life right now? I sometimes find myself feeling a little drained after meeting up with groups of people, even my best friends. I can't quite put my finger on why that is. I know I didn't always feel that way, but it can be easy sometimes to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves too thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. Dialing in and finding the right balance is going to be different for each person, whether you're somebody who thrives around people or if you prefer more alone time. Either way, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Therapy is not just for people who've experienced major traumas. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills, how to set boundaries, and it empowers you to be the best version of yourself. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, and the service is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a quick questionnaire that will match you up with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/filmdaily today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/filmdaily.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for Wednesday, March 22nd, 2023. On today's episode, we're going to have a spoiler-filled conversation about The Mandalorian, Chapter 20, The Foundling. This is Slash Film Editorial Director Peter Serretta, and joining me on today's podcast is Slash Film Editor Brett Oman.
Hey, that's me.
And Star Wars expert Brian Young.
I'm thrilled to be here.
So guys, I wasn't here last week, and I was, be honest with you, I was totally expecting things to fall to pieces. I thought, like, oh, sure, the podcast will not be as good. And then I listened to the podcast, and it was better without me. So what I'm saying is,
I don't know about that.
I'm going to take that as a compliment, but say we missed you.
Yeah, for sure.
I loved your conversation that you had, your impromptu conversation about how the expanded books and comics and TV shows. How they fix things or expand on things, and Brian's feeling is on what he thinks about that. I thought that was really insightful and really, really interesting. Okay. Let me say what I thought of last week's episode, because I wasn't here. It was very good. It was very unexpected to have this solo story following Dr. Pershing, and I don't know where it's going, and it was very compelling while watching it. But have we had previous seasons where it had a bottle episode like that following a different character?
Not where we had like bookends that like introduced and ended the episode. This was like the longest and like biggest departure, because usually they jump back and forth if they're going to do something like this. And it's kind of surprising they didn't, but I guess it made sense considering what happens with Mando and Grogu, you know, really only works with the beginning and the end, because there's not much of a middle there.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is definitely something that they did on Book of Boba Fett, which should have been getting used to this style of storytelling.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Hey, I'm not complaining. I'm just wondering, because everything's starting to blur together to me, guys. So I don't know. I'm like, did they do a Cara Dune episode? Maybe they did. I don't remember at this point. Do you know what I mean? Like, so it's like, I was just wondering if this is something they have done before.
Didn't they do one that was mostly a Grogu adventure, though?
Maybe. Did they do a Boba Fett episode? I probably should have looked this up before.
They gave him a whole series.
Well, yeah, yes.
They gave him 3 of 6 episodes or whatever.
Okay. You know, usually we start with feedback where we read your emails. You can write to us at peter@slashfilm.com with your thoughts, you have a problem with something we say on the podcast, you have speculation, something we missed, write us peter@slashfilm.com. We don't really have any emails to read this week, but I do have something I wanted to bring up. This is an interview that Dave Filoni did with The Wrap, and The Wrap asked Dave Filoni, I thought this question was interesting. He said, I'm going to read it here. Kathy Kennedy said in 2020 that the series would come to a climactic story event. But more recently, John has said The Mandalorian could go on forever. Are you building towards a climactic story event, or has that been put aside? And Filoni's answer is, well, from a certain point of view, it could. It could build a climactic thing, and The Mandalorian could still go on. It's not necessarily either or, is it? It's an interesting way to think about it. I tend to think, as we've been working on The Mandalorian and then writing Ahsoka, and then John Watts came in with the Skeleton Crew, there's an entire time period that is post-Return of the Jedi, and I look at that time period, which before The Force Awakens is around 30 years of time. When you look at the original trilogy, it's much less significant amount of time that those three movies take place in. And so what I like is that we're really building very slowly an ecosystem of characters and politics in events in the post Return of the Jedi time period, and that may or may not expand in a bigger way as we add more shows to it and add more characters to it. The good thing is that we're all talking creatively together about where these stories are all going. And I love whiteboards, and I whiteboard everything and have timelines. They always start back with The Phantom Menace and always go out to The Rise of Skywalker. I have all these slots in between and where everybody's doing everything, so I can look at it all and commiserate with Kathy on what's going on here and where it's going. It's very fun. I think the reality of there being a big event in this time period is very, very real. It's all I would say to that. But yes, if John wanted to keep making Mandalorian stories, as long as he does not get bumped off in said Titanic event, then they, I suppose, could continue. There doesn't seem to be any lack of interest in Grogu and Mando, that's for sure. So I wanted to hear what you guys thought about that. Like, do you think that's what we were going to? Are we going to head towards a climactic event and then The Mandalorian will continue after that? Or is that the end of all the storytelling that's headed towards this?
I think the thing with Dave Filoni is that he speaks in riddles purposely so that you could read that as either way, because he knows exactly what he's doing in that regard. And I also, my other side comment about that is I could hear people's like heads exploding when Dave Filoni's talking about how they're actually working toward Force Awakens and Rise of Skywalker. but what I think is going to happen is Jon Favreau has made no secret of the fact that he wants to just keep telling stories with these characters, but they've also built something and they're building to something. And I think that the last couple of episodes have really showed us that they're building to something. And I think the Ahsoka show is going to add to that. So yeah, we're going to get some cool climactic event, but yeah, I think we'll go on beyond that.
Yeah, I think similar to how, you know, obviously the Marvel Cinematic Universe, they culminated in Avengers movies every now and then. And overall, we had Avengers Endgame as a nice period on the first saga of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But they're still continuing movies. They're still doing TV shows. So I can easily see it being like that. It probably won't be quite as, big as far as having so many different installments all connected. But obviously, Mando and Ahsoka share some things together, and Boba Fett, if we want to include him, that's fine too.
do you think this is all going to lead into a movie, or do you think it will like a theatrical movie, or do you think it will be a Disney Plus movie, or do you think it will be a Disney Plus series?
I mean, it would be very cool if it was a movie. I feel like if they're going to do a movie, they should go theatrical with it. But at the same time, I think then you run into the problem of, the same issue you have when you turn any TV show into a movie is, is there enough there for people who, if they haven't been keeping up with the TV shows, to go see it? Are the people who are keeping up with the TV shows enough of a reason to make the movie? Because I think if Star Wars has proven anything right now is that there really needs to be like an audience there for them to make a movie, because, you know, they didn't really entirely show up for Solo. You know, that was a box office problem, and that really changed the trajectory of what Star Wars was doing. And that's why we're getting, you know, these Disney Plus shows instead of movies for some of these characters. So I think it depends. But, you know,
I think people didn't want a Solo prequel. And I feel like the audience interest is here for Mandalorian Grogu.
I talk to a lot of people who, you know, in that time between Solo left theaters in December, because it was a pretty short theatrical window, that they didn't even know it had come out yet. They were waiting for December. So I think that there was just as much like problems with Disney changing up the distribution pattern for Star Wars movies as anything else. I don't think there's actually all that many people who were like, I don't want more Han Solo, especially if it's another actor. I think most people sort of generally agree that at worst, the Solo movie's harmless, but I think most people tend to enjoy it. It's pretty well regarded among fans, I feel like.
I mean, I'm not saying it's not well regarded. I just feel like, I don't know. It seemed like the response to something like Rogue One, where it was new characters and a new thing, seemed like there was more people interested in that than there were like a prequel story of any kind of any character, not you know, singling out, Han Solo. I don't know. There's many reasons why that could have maybe not connected, and we could probably have an hour long conversation about why it didn't do well at the box office. But I don't know. Okay, let me pose the question to you guys: which would you rather see? Would you rather see like an epic miniseries event, like a 5-episode miniseries of event on Disney Plus, or would you rather see a 2-hour movie that's theatrical for this thing?
I think it depends on, I guess, what groundwork is laid and like what the story is. I think that I would like to see a big budget applied to, you know, Mandalorian and Grogu and Ahsoka, because I think those characters deserve it, and it would be cool, you know, to see them use a lot, you know, bigger budget on VFX and whatever they need to, you know, expand the scope of their story. But then again, you know, maybe a miniseries where they can spend a little bit more money, a little bit more time, you know, would also be just as satisfying. You know, I think it just depends.
I mean, I want it theatrical, even if that's one movie or if that's 5 episodes. I still say I would go pay at the box office to see The Mandalorian every Saturday matinee in a movie theater rather than just watch it on the small screen. I would do that even if they were releasing it on Wednesdays on Disney Plus, because it just looks so much better on the big screen. So even if they were to do that whole 5-episode miniseries, super series, or whatever you want to call it, I would go watch that in the theater too. But yeah, no, I prefer movie theaters just generally. So I feel like I'm biased in that regard.
I love how Brian, when he answers the question, he changes the question to would he watch Mandalorian every week in theaters? I guess what I was asking Brian is like, would you be happier with a bigger budget 2-hour movie or a 5-hour home experience?
Well, and I guess, I mean, the answer to my question is I would prefer whatever got me in the movie theater.
So the 2-hour movie.
So the 2-hour movie, or they could make the 5 hours and just put them in the theater slowly.
Hey, I think we would all do that if they were doing it. I would be in theaters every week for The Mandalorian if they did it, but doesn't seem like that's the business plan.
But, no, it's not.
Yeah. Okay. That is actually, you know what? I wasn't going to bring this up because Ben talked about this yesterday on the podcast, but there was a couple Star Wars news stories yesterday. And since this is a shorter episode, I think it's going to be a shorter discussion. I thought I'd bring it up with Damon Lindelof leaving his Star Wars movie that he was going to be doing. We don't really know much more beyond that, but it's been reported. I think Jeff Snyder broke the story. And I talked to Ryan Scott on this podcast on Monday. He had this interview with Damon Lindelof, and it was very interesting quote that now in retrospect, if you read the quote, it really sounds like he had already decided to leave at that point. So I wanted to hear what you guys thought of this. Like, what are your thoughts on Lindelof leaving another high profile name who was attached to a Star Wars thing, leaving Lucasfilm.
I'm really glad that they're demanding that perfection and are willing to not move forward with stuff if it's not ready, because I think that might have been a problem with The Force Awakens.
Well, this doesn't sound like they're not moving forward with it because it's not ready, because it's the story says that Lucasfilm is getting new writers and they still plan on announcing the project at Star Wars Celebration in April. So I think if anything, this is just a testament to, you know, like a lot of people, including us, like we're all armchair, you know, critics. We're all seeing the situation, providing our commentary and our, you know, opinions and everything. But this is a really difficult job, crafting something for, you know, millions of fans, a lot of them which can't agree on what they want, and doing something that fits squarely within a universe that a lot of people have different perspectives on what truly defines it. And when you're trying to figure out something that not only fits in that universe, but also takes it in a new direction, that's a supremely difficult job. And I think that, you know, even somebody like Damon Lindelof saying, you know, in the quote that he provided in our interview with Ryan Scott, that it is extremely, extremely difficult. And, you know, it even gave him reservations about whether or not he should be trying to make a Star Wars story or if he should just let somebody else do it. And it sounds like he figured out the latter, you know. And so maybe it comes down to like Lucasfilm wanting something different than what he wanted. And if he didn't feel like he could deliver that, then he felt like he should put it in somebody else's hands. But I don't think that these kinds of stories are necessarily a bad thing, because it means that like the project's still happening and they're just figuring out what the best way is for it to move forward and to hopefully give people what they want to see from Star Wars.
I just think it's interesting that a lot of people are getting into that kitchen that they've, you know, you know, he said that that was the first film he's ever seen in the theater. And it's like you get into that kitchen and then you decide, oh, maybe I just want to eat the food. I don't want to actually cook in this kitchen. And it's something that seems to be happening time and time again. So I don't know. I'll use the word interesting, because I was really, I'm a huge Damon Lindelof fan, and I was really excited to see what he would do in the Star Wars galaxy. And I got to say, I'm disappointed that he's not continuing on with this project. But I'm curious to see what it is, because I'm sure whatever he's contributed to it, Brad, he might still get like a credit, right? Like even with new writers coming on and stuff, it might be substantial work.
Yeah, there's been plenty of times, especially on big blockbuster movies, where like the studio will still use some of the ideas that came from the original script. And even if a lot of the script has been overhauled, there's still a tangible amount, enough that's in there that like the writer still gets credit. So I wouldn't be surprised if we still see a writing credit for Damon Lindelof.
Yeah. And the other bit of news I wanted to briefly mention was the Daniels are doing an episode of Skeleton Crew. How cool is that?
Ridiculously.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, I'm a fan of theirs, and I'm excited to see what they can do in the Star Wars galaxy. It'll be interesting. Okay, let's jump into this episode. Let's talk about our brief thoughts. Brad, what are your brief thoughts on The Foundling?
A pretty basic episode, short and sweet, some cool stuff. I think that this is the first time in a while that I really enjoyed the Grogu stuff more than the Mandalorian stuff. We get a little bit of insight into his origins, a cool little cameo appearance, and there's still some cool Mandalorian action too. You know, I always like seeing a team of Mandalorians take to the sky, use their weapons and whatnot. But this definitely felt more in line with the like adventure of the week formula that we're used to seeing from The Mandalorian.
Yeah, this felt very season one Mandalorian. Brian, brief thoughts on The Foundling.
Despite some really hilarious jumps in logic that just make me laugh in this episode, I really enjoyed it. It pushed my buttons in the right way, especially with the flashback sequence and the cameos and everything that all of that implied. And I'm really interested in where this is ultimately heading, even if we got there in kind of a silly way with Bo-Katan. I think that was the most interesting thing about this episode, is that the two stars of this episode were Bo-Katan and Grogu and not Din Djarin. He was very much a side character.
Yeah, no, that is an interesting thought. I didn't even think about that. My thoughts are, I don't know. I was enjoying this episode as it was happening, but I kind of don't like that it's the shortest episode of the series so far. The side quest that's in it kind of seems to come out of nowhere and doesn't seem to be all that important. Like, it really seems like the quest of the week thing that we were doing in season one of The Mandalorian doesn't really seem to be furthering the main story. I guess it is because it's setting up Bo-Katan and her relationship with this tribe. But yes, I think what was most compelling to me was Grogu's backstory. And I got to say, it was not at all what I expected. If I had the bingo card for all the things that I expected to happen in Grogu's backstory, I don't think I would have gotten any chips or wouldn't have stamped the card at all. So, but we can talk about that in a second. Let's get into the breakdown. This episode is directed by Carl Weathers, who obviously plays Greef Karga in the series. But he's best known as an actor. He's also directed 17 episodes of TV over the last two decades, including Silk Stockings, Hawaii Five-0, and Law and Order. And I wanted to ask you guys, how do you think Carl Weathers did in his Mandalorian directorial debut?
I think it was fine. I think there was a really interesting kinetic energy to everything, and it can't have been easy to have directed the fight with a bunch of Mandalorians on jetpacks, right? Like, that's actually a really technically complicated scene, especially when you realize that there are no actual pterosaurs and things, and that would take a lot of work and skill to be able to pull off a sequence like that, actually. So I think he was, you know, he did what he needed to do to get that episode together.
Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, he learned a lot too from being, you know, on set as one of the stars of The Mandalorian, because, you know, he was involved in that, you know, Mandalorian shootout there was, back in, was it season two, I think, right? Is that early on in season two, or is that later in season one? Whichever.
Season one, I think at the end of season one was the shootout, with the bar and stuff. So what you're talking about?
So he's been around and he's seen how stuff is done. So I'm sure, you know, even if he hadn't necessarily tackled something that big before, that was something that helped immensely. And he's been around for a while, you know, so he knows how to do stuff like deliver, you know, action with emotion, that kind of thing. So yeah, good on him.
Yeah, no, I thought it was a fine episode, directorially speaking. And yeah, I mean, especially coming from where he, if you look at his list of credits of stuff he's directed, I think this must be the most action he's done. Actually, if you combine the 16 episodes of TV he's directed, I think there's more action in this episode. So yeah, that is challenging for sure, like Brian said. Okay, so the opening scene featured all the Mandalorians of this covert practicing combat, and makes me wonder, like, is this what they do every day? Like, is
I wondered that too, because what else is there to do? Like, if they're not, like, what are they doing? Like, this entire time, what else is there to do? And also, this feels like a tremendous waste of resources. Like, they're firing rockets out into the water. Like, they're, I mean, sure, like, there are shooting ranges in the real world, and like, you're shooting bullets and stuff like that, but these feel like a lot more costly resources.
Yeah, especially some of those things like whistling birds and stuff, which are supposed to be rare, and Beskar steel and all that stuff. But you know, I just imagine a world where, you know, Bo-Katan is on her throne sulking every day, and the Mandalorians are just like shooting weapons into the water every day. And I don't know. What did you guys think of this whole sequence? I also thought, like, I want to say this as a criticism. I thought that it could have been cooler. It seemed like kind of a free-for-all. Like, everybody's just, like, having fun. Like, I kind of expected a Mandalorian combat practice to be, like, this big structured game. Like, you know, capture the flag thing. And, like, they're, like, in groups. And it's, like, this big, like, I don't know, I guess, like, Halo kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? Like,
the thing the thing for me is that it fit the story really well, because if you watch how Carl Weathers actually photographs this sequence, it's from Bo-Katan's perspective, and it feels very chaotic and like she's out of place. And that's, I think, by design, because she feels very out of place there. And that chaos comes through the performance in her helmet, which is actually, I don't know if that's something we should credit to Katie Sackhoff, the other performers, Carl Weathers, the editing, whatever, that magical combination. It coalesced to really tell a story visually about how out of place she felt. And that's why I really enjoyed the chaos of this training scene.
I also do wonder if it's like a way of showing too how she sees this chaos among them, and maybe she's like thinking about how maybe she can be like the leader that they need. Like that if, you know, if she's willing to adhere to the old ways, that maybe she can provide some guidance for them and, you know, allow them to do something, you know, more meaningful with their skills and whatnot, you know, seeing what they can do and hopefully be able to harness their abilities in some way.
Yeah, for a sequence that's largely action and just really cool visuals and, you know, dudes shooting guns and stuff, it actually packed a lot of story ideas in what that represented in a way that I thought was really, it was really competent.
Especially in, and we'll talk about this here in a second, but like when they get into the sparring and, you know, Din encourages Grogu to, you know, engage with the other foundling for like a sparring battle, the way Bo-Katan, you know, talks to Grogu in a little bit more of like a sweeter bedside manner fashion to like encourage him and, you know, recognizing that like, hey, you know what, this might be difficult, but, you know, I dealt with this too. And, you know, just kind of like breaking things down for him in a way that is a little... I don't know, less, not abrasive. I don't know what word I'm looking for, but you know what I mean.
It's almost there's motherly. That. Like, is Bo-Katan becoming Grogu's mama, I guess?
Well, I think she does offer a really good counterbalance to that paternal sort of aggression. Like, yeah, get in the ring, kid. You're tough. You're my kid. Of course you are. You know, that sort of thing that Din Djarin has for him.
For sure. So Bo spots Grogu in the corner. He's sitting in the sand as the rocks around him are moving. And I think we're led to believe that at first we think that Grogu is actually using the Force to move the rocks around. But then it's revealed that no, he's not using the Force to move them. There are actually little hermit crabs inside the rocks. And it's a really cute moment with Grogu. But I think also... I might be reaching here. Tell me if I'm reaching here, but I think it's teasing a deeper idea that there's more going on below the surface that we might not initially realize.
Yeah, I had a different read on that, actually, because I don't think it's... I think at first it is meant to imply that he was moving the rocks himself, and then you see that he wasn't because of all the whatever crabs, hermit crabs. They were Star Wars hermit crabs. But then I wonder, like... if they were really showing, maybe what he wasn't doing was moving them. Maybe he was stopping them all from moving, and it was a way of showing how powerful Grogu is still becoming with the Force.
I think both of those are actually really good reads on it. But my interest was really at the end when it reveals that they were none of them were rocks and they were all crabs, and it made me feel like Grogu is really learning what's under the helmet, right, of everyone around, because that's essentially the society he's living in. Everybody's wearing a rock over their head the same way all these crabs are.
That's a good point as well. So Mando offers Grogu as the next challenger in the foundling fight training group, and he goes up against the boy who was inducted into the group a couple episodes ago. His name is Ragnar, and we learned that Grogu doesn't wear a helmet yet because he's one too young to, or no, because he's too young to speak the creed is what they said. So I guess this answers a question a bunch of people have had, a bunch of fans watching the show has had, like, you know, when do you wear the helmet? And I guess that's like after you are old enough to speak the creed and actually believe the creed. And also that to me, a lot of people have been kind of assuming that we'd see Grogu wearing a Mandalorian helmet by the end of the series at some point. Like, there's a lot of fan art and stuff like that. Does this mean that we'll actually have to have a fully talking Grogu for that to happen?
Yeah.
Do you think it's going
to
happen?
Unless something happens to Din Djarin and in a fit of rage, he puts on his slain father's helmet or something.
That would be too big.
I think it's hilarious that he's too young to speak the creed, but not too young to fight.
Yeah. Do you think, I don't think I've ever asked you guys this, but do you think that we'll ever see Grogu wearing a Mandalorian helmet?
I don't know. I mean, I think it partially depends on how this whole, you know, combination of Mandalorian sects works out. If whether or not we're going to see some kind of hybrid of, the Mandalorians who follow the way and like Bo-Katan's, you know, followers or anything like that, if it'll be something where he needs to wear a helmet to be Mandalorian. I think the more important question is if Grogu does have to wear a helmet, does it have to contain his ears, or will his helmet have slots so his ears stick out?
I think it'll have slots.
Yeah, a lot of the fan art has slots. I think it would look ridiculous I guess technically if you're building a helmet, it should go around the ears, right? It's supposed to protect you.
True.
But yeah, I think that'd look ridiculous if you made a helmet going around the ears.
And would it be too hard to make a helmet where the ears are metal around him?
Okay, so this duel is with training darts, and it's kind of like Star Wars paintball. And Bo-Katan doesn't believe Grogu knows how to fire darts, but Mando does. Grogu gets hit twice, and Mando encourages him to show them what he can really do. So are we to read here that Grogu was scared to show his force powers off in front of the Mandalorian covert? Is that what was going on?
I get the impression that Grogu, especially with the stuff in the flashback, if he's going to spend any amount of time with a Jedi on the run in the days after Order 66, that the training he's going to get is going to be keep this a secret from everyone. Right.
Yeah.
And so overcoming that is going to take a while for him because he spent so many years hiding that.
That definitely makes sense. But he actually does trust them enough to show that he can jump around high in the air like Yoda and fire all three darts in a rapid succession on Ragnar. And everyone isn't impressed, including Bo-Katan, who asks if Din taught Grogu. And he simply says, not me.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the final episode of season two since it aired. But who was there to witness Grogu leaving with Luke? Who knows about that?
Moff Gideon, Bo-Katan, Fennec Shand, Boba Fett, Boba Fett was on the ship elsewhere. So it was Fennec Shand, yeah. Bo-Katan, Din and Moff Gideon.
So Bo-Katan knows that he went off and trained with Luke.
Yeah.
So it seems like a stupid question to me. No?
Well, I mean, maybe, I mean, he's been with Din a lot longer than he was with Luke. It's reasonable to assume that he'd been training.
That's true. It's also interesting that the Mandalorian and the Armorer especially are so willing to accept a Force user into their covert. Because, like, didn't the Armorer, like, kind of say some bad things about the Jedi previously? That they were, like, their enemy or something?
They were. They were. But that was in their ancient history.
Yeah. It's just interesting because this group seems to be so tied to like ancient history and like the rules, the way, all that stuff. But they're so the fact that the Armorer is willing to accept this guy with with force powers into the covert. Like, I don't know. I think it's interesting. I'm not going to say it's like, it's not a criticism of any kind. But I think it's interesting that, that she's not tied to like the history of stuff. If that makes sense. Okay. Anyway, so the one person not impressed by was Paz Vizsla, who it turns out is related to Ragnar, which we speculated a couple episodes ago. He's his father, and well, you know what? What were you going
to
say?
This is one of those questions because they refer to him as a foundling a few times.
Okay, well, adopted father, I'm going
to
say.
Yeah, but, well, because I was trying to figure out, too, because I was like, wait, if it's actually his kid, when, like, because when we saw them on Book of Boba Fett, the covert was just the two of them. Like, did his ex have custody or something, and he came and, like, abducted him to, you know, because this is the way? I don't know. So it seems like wherever they found this kid, Paz Vizsla feels very attached to him one way or the other enough to call him a dad.
Yes. And, you know, it's been a long while since we've kind of talked about Paz. Brian, can you give us a refresher on who Paz Vizsla is?
So Paz Vizsla, we don't know a whole lot about him specifically, but his family was associated with Death Watch. Pre-Vizsla, which was another Mandalorian that Jon Favreau voiced in the Clone Wars, was the leader of Death Watch and allied with Maul to... take back Mandalore away from the pacifists led by Bo-Katan's sister. Paz Vizsla has been in this covert and was one of the children of the Watch, waited out the purge on Concordia with the rest of them, and then joined the covert on Navarro and helped fight the Imperials alongside Din Djarin in the Book of Boba Fett. He challenged Din Djarin for possession of the Darksaber and lost. And he's been sort of skeptical about Din Djarin and him being an apostate ever since he revealed he had taken his helmet off. And so this episode's also him warming up to them, warming back up to Din a little bit.
Yeah. Am I correct to say that he's still voiced by Jon Favreau?
It sounds like Jon Favreau to me. I know that somebody had, you know, I looked in the credits and they changed it to the body performer.
Yeah, Tate Fletcher is the guy that's credited in the credits, and he was in Breaking Bad. He played Lester. He was in a bunch of stuff. Bigger dude.
But that also fits with the mode of them giving credit to the people in the Mandalorian costumes. You know how you've got Brendan Wayne and Lateef Crowder getting credit in the episodes now too. So it seems like it could just match that.
I wanted to ask you guys, if Paz Vizsla ever gets unmasked in this series or in any show or movie, what is it going to look like under the mask? Is it going to look like Tate Fletcher, or is it going to look like Jon Favreau?
I'd bet Tate Fletcher.
You think so? My one argument against this is they have a Black Series action figure of Jon Favreau underneath that mask. Is that canon?
No. I mean, like, how many action figures are there where they have, like, all Halloween coloring or, like, the Christmas elf stormtroopers and stuff? What does that matter?
You make a good point. Okay.
But to be fair, the Dave Filoni figure that they made is of his actual canon character, so...
I don't know. Okay, anyways, we might not ever see him unmasked, so that's just a ridiculous question anyways. So this giant leathery winged raptor-like creature flies over the covert and snatches a Ragnar. Brian, is this a creature we've ever seen before in the Star Wars universe?
Not that I could find. I know that there are some ties to other creatures like this. It looks a little bit like a creature that was called a pterosaur in the old legends, but it also looks like the head looks like the creature from the holiday special that Boba Fett rides, which is more land-based than this. So I think it's a mishmash of old things to be made new.
The audio description track keeps on calling it a raptor. I don't think that's its name, but that's what I'm going to refer to it as
They refer to it as a raptor in the show too.
Oh, in what?
In dialogue, they call it a raptor. Bo-Katan calls it a raptor.
Oh, okay. I didn't notice that. Okay, I have a question for you guys. Why have the Mandalorians chose this planet tied on when it seems like there's all those vicious creatures? There's these raptors that have apparently multiple times come and snatched up foundlings or Mandalorians, and I'm assuming they killed them. And then there's like these turtle creatures underneath the water right outside their cave. It seems like they could find a better place to have this hideout.
Well, it's probably not easy to find a place to have a secret hideout. And I think if you look back at the history of Star Wars, almost everywhere you go, there's going to be some kind of deadly creature around that's going to ruin your day at some point. But I also think that it's kind of tradition at this point for the Mandalorians to have bad luck finding a place to call their own, because every place they've been has been destroyed or ambushed. So
that's true. I just feel like after like one or two of the Mandalorians were snatched by raptors, I'd be like, okay, let's find a different place. But maybe they are like too prideful to do that. Maybe they're like, we've seen kind of pride with the Mandalorians, and like they're unwilling to, like, you know, they already had their home taken away from them. So like, why are they going to leave because of this creature? They're going to eventually want to take him out.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, it's similar to like, you know, other ancient cultures who didn't let, you know, the land or anything decide where they lived. Like, they chose a place and that was their home, and they dealt with, you know, the consequences that were around. My question, though, is how exactly are they getting from place to place? Because they obviously don't have any ships of their own that we see. Otherwise, they would probably be using them. They have their jetpacks, but as we see in this episode, it only gets them so far until they run out of fuel. So are they just like taking the bus from planet to planet until they find a place?
I don't think there's any bus on this planet, as far as I can tell.
Well, there are transports from planets to other planets, though, as we've established. Oh, yeah.
This is one of those things that made me wonder, like, where are they getting all these people, and how did they get there? And if Bo-Katan's the only one with a ship, like, it's one of those things where it's like, I'm sure maybe there's just some part of the set, or maybe further back into the armorer's cave, there's a ship big enough for them all to get on or something. But it definitely strains credulity a little bit.
Yes. Okay, so the Mandalorians take off in jetpacks in pursuit of the creature, but apparently they chase them so far that their fuel and their jetpacks run out. And of course, Bo-Katan took a different approach and pursues the creature in her ship. And is then we cut to the title, the chapter title is revealed, The Foundling. Brian, I always ask you every episode to explain the title. This one, I think, seems a little bit more obvious, but it does seem like there's multiple foundlings, right?
Oh, I think it refers to just about everybody on this show, right? Like, Din Djarin was the original foundling that the show is following. Grogu is the foundling that he took in and is trying to coach and train. There's the foundling that Ragnar is taken hostage. It's the new foundlings. At the end of the episode with the new raptor creatures brought into the Mandalorian fold. And then as well as Bo-Katan. Bo-Katan is very much a foundling to this group as well. And I think she's ultimately the one who we're referencing the hardest, because it's her moral quandary or her emotional journey that we're going on over the course of the episode.
For sure. Okay, so Bo-Katan returns and says that she found the creature's lair. She's going to set up a hunting party. The nest is in this tall mountain, but if they use their jetpacks, it would alert the beast and Ragnar would be killed. They found that has happened in the past where they've like either shot it or made noise, like, and the person got killed. So Bo-Katan plans to scale the mountain by hand, which is something she is done before in training, and she mentions a place, and I think you wrote a whole article about this, Brian.
Yeah, I did, because that's what I do. So she mentions that she went to the peaks of Kirin Morrit, and that was where she trained in climbing. And the episode really treats it as a throwaway, but in the old Legends continuity, Kirin Morrit was a place on Mandalore that was less mountainous peaks and more jungle forest. And it was where Mandalorians, a Mandalorian clan formed there. that is very much like this covert, where they just took in all the dregs. During the Clone Wars, this clan took in clones trying to desert from the clone army. After the Empire came about, they took in Jedi that were running from the Empire. And so there's a lot of thematic ties to what Kirimorut, what it was in the old legends, to what it is, to what it's referencing now, and to what the covert is. So that was something that came about first in the Republic Commando books, which was a tie-in to that really terrific Republic Commando video game. And Karen Travis, the author who sort of became the premier Mandalorian author for a while until Clone Wars sort of broke enough of what she was doing, she sort of rage quit Star Wars, and went off. It was actually pretty spectacular if you were around in Star Wars watching her have her meltdown over that.
Wait, what happened exactly? Oh, I don't think I've heard the story.
The Clone Wars just kept breaking all of the Legends material that she had been making in these other books, right? She really focused in on Mandalorian culture. And in season two, when the Mandalorians started coming to the forefront and it sort of rewrote everything she'd established about Mandalorian culture, she got very upset about it and kind of had a meltdown, a very public meltdown about it.
Interesting. Okay, so Bo-Katan and a small group take off on this hunting mission, leaving Grogu behind, and the armorer is making something for the foundling. And here's something I wanted to bring up for a while. Is it weird that the apparent leader of this group is the armorer?
Is she a leader, or is she like a holy person? Like, if you had a monastery of Buddhist monks, Buddhist warrior monks, and they didn't necessarily have a leader, but they had the person who's the wisest among them who kept the stories. Would they be the leader, or would they be, you know, the mystic?
Okay, I can see that. That's a good argument. So the armorer uses a metaphor to explain the Mandalorian's armor, how it represents the growth of the people inside the armor. Brian, I'm sure you have thoughts on this.
It's definitely the armor is supposed to be representative of people. And I think actually what she's talking about is less Grogu and actually referring thematically to Bo-Katan for later in the episode. That was my take on it, especially as I watched it a second time. But she was talking to Grogu about what that armor represented for him and how he would grow into it. And I thought it was very telling that she put the sigil of the Mudhorn on it, which is actually funny because when you think back to season one, it was Grogu who defeated the Mudhorn, not Din.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. While the armor forges, Grogu experiences this memory. He remembers this moment from Order 66, where Order 66 was called, and he was part of the Jedi Academy in Coruscant. And by the way, I was thinking, we've been seeing a lot of Order 66 in these TV shows lately. I think it would be fun if someone were to create a supercut of like trying to show everything in narrative order of everything intercutting between.
That exists. People have done a 4-hour cut of Revenge of the Sith cutting in all of this stuff, and they keep adding to it, whether it's these shows or the Order 66 scenes in Jedi Fallen Order, the game. So it does exist. It's out there.
Okay, good to know. We've seen glimpses of this moment before, but we have never seen how it actually plays out. And in this moment, four Jedi are holding the clone troopers back as Grogu glides on his pram. And in the end, they are all killed trying to, quote, get him to Kelleran. And before we dive into that and who Kelleran is, I wanted to ask you guys, actually, Brad, maybe you have an answer for this one. Should we read anything into the fact that four Jedi Masters are trying to protect this one child? Is there something special about Grogu, or would they do that for any Padawan or whatever?
I think it's possible, but it does seem like it's more of a thing of just the Jedi trying to protect the younglings because they're not necessarily as ready or able to defend themselves. And so I think they're just trying to keep him safe because he's the one who is near them at that point. But it is, I will say, it is entirely possible that maybe there is something special about him, especially since this is the only other, other than Yoda and Yaddle, the only other form of this species that we've seen as a Jedi until now.
Is it called the Yoda species still? Is that canon or no?
No.
Do you know? No.
The closest I've been able to get in any of the licensed work is to refer to them as a tridactyl species.
Tridactyl.
But that just refers to how many fingers and toes they have.
Brian, any thoughts on this? Like, are we supposed to read into this in any way that like there's something special about Grogu, or is it just like they would be doing this for any child?
I think they would be doing it for any child. If you remember in Obi-Wan Kenobi, this is what they were doing for the group of younglings led by Reva Savander.
Yeah.
So I think this was just, they were trying to do this with younglings, with the exception of the ones they're like, we should put these ones in the Jedi Council chamber. That surely will be safe there.
Okay, so Kelleran Beck is here, and we're going to get Grogu to Kelleran Beck, and he's taken outside this elevator and escapes with Kelleran Beck. Now, if all of us had written 100 characters down of who could save Grogu in this one moment, I don't think any of us would have put Kelleran Beck.
No, I don't think. I mean, maybe if I were getting to the bottom of the list going like, what other Jedi do I know about? because Kelleran Beck, I didn't think he was canon.
I didn't think
he was. I think what they were sort of calling canon adjacent, right? Like the Lego stuff, where it was like, here's a character, he could exist in the canon, but here's the story we came up with for him. But for those who don't know, Kelleran Beck came from the Star Wars Jedi Temple Challenge, which was a YouTube show that they produced a couple years ago. That
was
a send up. It was a send up of the Nickelodeon sort of kids challenge game shows like Double Dare or Legends of the Hidden Temple. Yeah. And it was hosted by Ahmed Best, who created this character of Kelleran Beck, who just really wanted to teach younglings. That was his calling, was the younglings. And so the show took place on his ship, where he tested various Jedi younglings in their skills, but it was actually real kids doing the Double Dare Legends of the Hidden Temple thing. And it wasn't anything, you know, I was kind of hoping we'd get another season of it because it was just a fun, adorable show. And I think Disney Plus is missing a trick, not putting it on Disney Plus because it's only on YouTube. But yeah, I never would have guessed that he would have made the jump to canon, especially not in so dramatic a fashion.
And we should also mention, for those people that don't know, Ahmed Best is probably best known for portraying Jar Jar Binks in The Phantom Menace, and he has said that role has kind of haunted him. So this is kind of a vindication of sorts. Redemption, I guess, is a word in Star Wars. No?
No, I mean, I don't think Jar Jar needed any redeeming, but I do think fans have softened on that character, and there's a lot of regret on the part of the fandom that did sort of give him the worst time for it, I hope.
Yeah.
Because I think people are softening, like they're realizing like, yeah, I didn't like Jar Jar, but that guy didn't do anything wrong, and we treated him like crap. But I do think being a character who's so cool, like he's cool in this, right? Like the determination and anger and look on his face when he's doing all this stuff here is just like, he's cool.
Yes. We should also mention that in the Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones, Ahmed Best played a character named Ahmed Beck, who Best has confirmed in interviews is actually related to this new character, or not new character, this more recent character.
Kelleran Beck. Yeah.
Kelleran Beck. and Best is described back as the first Jedi dedicated to teaching, adding that he had been inspired by Kenobi and Yoda's nurturing kind of mentorship. And here's something interesting, and I think, Brian, you might have even written about this, but Kellan Beck on the TV show, on the YouTube show, he had a lightsaber that was made of pieces that actually were created from Savi's workshop in Galaxy's Edge, which is something I think all three of us have partaken in that experience at this point.
Yes.
Brian, you've done it, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I've done it. That was a really tremendous experience. But yes, I want to say it's the Peace and Defender set that you can actually assemble Keller and Beck's lightsaber from. And I wrote a whole article about his saber because on the show it's a purple blade.
Yeah.
And he wielded green and blue here, and I sort of had to write up some ideas about why he didn't have the purple blade.
So why do you think he doesn't have the purple blade?
Mace Windu stole it.
Well, I think there's two there's the in-universe answer and the behind-the-scenes answer. The in-universe answer is there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of shit going on in Order 66, and he may well have lost his saber and picked up new ones. And in fact, there is a shot when I was rewatching it where he does pick up the saber of the Jedi that died in the elevator with Grogu.
But it's blue, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's definitely not his saber. So he's already working with sabers that aren't his own. I think the behind the scenes is probably they wanted to preserve the specialness of that purple saber on screen for Mace Windu.
Yeah, especially because I think Samuel Jackson, when that happened, specifically said he wanted to be the only person to have a purple lightsaber in the Star Wars universe.
Has it really not been another purple lightsaber even in like the animated stuff?
Not on screen. There have been some Jedi in the High Republic that have wielded purple lightsabers, but that's literally ancient history. No one on screen, to my recollection, has wielded a purple lightsaber. There have been yellow, and Rey is not the only one who has yellow.
Yeah.
That was with the Jedi Temple Guard. But yeah, everyone else has had a shade of blue, red, or green.
Okay, using his saber and the blue saber from that fallen Jedi, Beck, I should actually ask you, do we know any of these fallen Jedi that got killed, the four that were there?
I wasn't able to find any of their history or names or anything.
I think one of them was Glup Shiddo.
Possible. Okay, so anyway, he deflects the blaster shots from the oncoming clone troopers and makes quick work of them before jumping onto a speeder with Grogu. And we should also mention that that Tamara Morrison's is credited as the clone troopers here, so you hear his voice. What did you guys think of the chase sequence through Coruscant on the speeder?
I thought it was really cool to revisit Monument Plaza so quickly, even though it's at a point, you know, 20 years in the past, 30 years in the past.
Why do you think they use the same location? Is it just easier because it's built out?
It's a production budget thing, right? Like it's the same reason on Clone Wars where you'll talk to the production team, right? And they'll say, like, we've only got enough money for like one big new environment a season or something, or we can only rig X amount of aliens this season. But then next season, they still have all those assets and they can repurpose them or whatever. And so you noticed that's part of how Clone Wars and Bad Batch got better every season, is because they were able to just add to the assets they have because they were able to build that stuff. And I think Monument Plaza is one of those things that the last episode spent all the money to develop it and make it look rad and get it into the volume. And so why not create another moment here with something that they already had access to? It's a cost saver.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so Keller and Beck makes this rough landing to quote unquote meet up with some friends, and his friends seem to be some guards from Naboo, five royal Naboo guards. This is another thing that Brian wrote up for the site. Did Padme save Grogu?
I don't think so. I think Padme if you watch Revenge of the Sith and remember, she's literally watching the Jedi Temple burn from her apartment with no answers, waiting for Anakin to come back and give her those answers. This seems very much like Kelleran Beck reached out to someone else to ask for help and ask for a way out. And what other character of major standing on could be on Coruscant at this time would have access to guards from Naboo and a ship? And that would be Representative Binks. I really think that part of the reason it's funny, but like I honestly can't come up with another answer of who it could possibly be, because we see it very clearly not seem to be Padme from A Revenge of the Sith, and Jar Jar is the only person who's unaccounted for and of a status of position enough to be able to do that for him.
So Jar Jar Binks is the unsung hero of the Jedi Purge, apparently.
He saved Grogu.
Yeah.
I can hear Brad rolling his eyes.
Beck informs him that no, there are no others. Actually, I should ask you this, Brian. Do you think Beck... No, it couldn't be called of Carrie Beck because it predates Carrie Beck, right?
Yeah, it was a name. It was a name that they had come... It was like a George Lucas name when he's like, who are you going to be? And he's like, I don't know. And George Lucas is like, Ahmed Beck. Because it kind of sounds like I'm at best. And Kelleran Beck was the name they came up with for the show based on that.
And we should say Beck is B-E-Q or something. It's spelled weird. So he informs them that there are no others. Does he mean that there's no other Jedi escaped from Order 66 assault in the temple? Or does he mean there's no others with him? Were they expecting others?
The impression I got, and you two correct me if I'm reading this wrong, is that he was trying to meet a group of Jedi in that elevator and they were going to make their escape, and he'd arranged for the travel arrangements for them to get away. And at the end of the day, when he opens the elevator and looks down shocked, all he sees is Grogu, his dead friend, and his lightsaber. He picks up the lightsaber and just keeps going, because if he stays to dally for more, he's going to die. So my guess is he was expecting to get that whole group out. Yeah. But Order 66 was much more horrific than even they would have realized.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
So a gunship filled with clone troopers lands on and the new Naboo guards give Beck and Grogu their ship. The Silver Starship takes off.
It's but an again, H-type Nubian yacht.
Sounds fancy.
It is. It's the same kind of ship Padme and Anakin took to Tatooine in Attack of the Clones.
Yeah.
It might even be the same one.
Oh, it might be. And it takes off and it's being pursued by a couple ships. Are these V-Wings?
These are the sort of TIE fighter precursors that were used by the Republic at the end of the Clone Wars. You see them in Revenge of the Sith a bunch.
Okay, so Kelleran jumps to light speed, and with that we are out of the flashback, and I am there being like, no, come on, that's it? Now we got to go back to the monster thing that I don't care about? Brad, what are your thoughts on this flashback as a whole?
I liked it. It's a nice, you know, gap to fill in. It shows that, I think we talked about this when we first saw a glimpse of this a while back, that we wondered if it was Anakin Skywalker who was behind the door, because, you know, it seemed like it was a lightsaber that was cutting through the door, but apparently not. A little disappointed there. But otherwise, I wonder if this is the first of several flashbacks we'll get, and that they'll keep continuing this flashback story as Grogu continues to experience new things as he's, you know, doing his Mandalorian training.
Yes. Okay, so the armorer gifts Grogu with the small rondel of Beskar steel that has a mudhorn symbol in it, and he'll grow into it eventually as part of his armor. And we saw that she like inlaid a bunch of like circuitry into the rondel. I didn't imagine that the Mandalorian armor had like technological stuff underneath it, but I guess it makes sense.
We've seen that before in the first episode when she was creating the rangefinder for Ragnar. She was doing some of the circuitry in that. And in the canon and even the Legends you know, like the reason those Mandalorians wear those helmets is because there is an impressive amount of technology in there to help them do their warrior business.
Yeah. So now we are back to the rescue mission with Bo-Katan. It's funny, whenever I type Bo-Katan into my phone, it changes it to No Karen. And I'm too lazy to change it. So
I'm happy with that as a slogan, No Karen.
Yeah, so every time I'm reading it, I have to, in my mind, translate No Karen into Bo-Katan. Leading the war party to the peak where they make camp and eat rations for dinner. And Bo learns that the way Mandalorians in the covert eat is they find a private place to remove their helmet. Seems very impractical, and I think Ryan Scott on the site wrote an article titled, "The More the Mandalorian Explains that Its Helmet Role, the More Questions We Have." Guys, how does I don't think we've ever asked this question on the podcast. Like, do Mandalorians have sex with, like, do they procreate? Like, do they take the helmet off if they're, like, intimate?
I mean, that stands to reason that maybe they do, or maybe there are different, maybe we'll learn other rules about, like, it would surprise me, right? If we got to a point on the show where they're like, Grogu and Din can no longer show each other their face. I wonder if they've both taken the creed and they're part of this same clan, that maybe there's some exception carved out for them, right? The same sort of carve out that you might find for two, you know, lovers procreating. But there's probably also a reason that almost no one except for the Children of the Watch do this helmet thing. It's because it probably gets really obnoxious during these times.
Peter, I'm sure you've, if this isn't already done, but now you've just unlocked a whole sect of erotic fan fiction of Mandalorians having sex with their helmets on.
Oh no. Is that a thing? Are you joking?
I don't know. Like, I mean, I imagine because of the internet, I'm sure it has to be out there somewhere, but yeah, now it's just Mandalorian sex where naked bodies and helmets on.
Are they allowed to remove their armor? Do they just need to have their helmet on?
It doesn't say anything about the armor, just the helmet.
Yeah.
This is okay. The way.
maybe by season 4, we'll learn more about this. Okay. The next morning, Bo leads the team up the rock face with grappling cables and such. And seems like it would have been so much easier to do this all without the heavy armor and the jetpacks, especially Paz Vizsla, who has that huge, like, repeating blaster. But whatever. So they make it to the top, and there's it's a huge nest. And you can see, like, you can even see a Mandalorian helmet from a previous feeding in, like, the twine there. And Vizsla is too emotionally involved and starts yelling for his son's name, which wakes up the babies in the nest. There's 3 baby raptor creatures here. And the adult raptor returns to the nest, and Paz covers himself with some brush, which somehow hides. How is that possible, Brian? How does the brush conceal his blue armor?
Maybe the visual acuity of this is based on movement. And okay. Since he's not moving, I don't know. That's not the thing that broke my head about this scene.
Oh, you're talking about so the mother raptor regurgitates Ragnar after having him in his mouth for a whole day?
2 days and a night.
Oh, because 2 days.
He got abducted the day before, spent all day, all night, and then all this day in the gullet of this creature. And he gets coughed up and just goes, "I'm still alive. Help me, please."
Why? We saw when Bo-Katan chased the raptor back to the nest that, like, the raptor got to the nest. So why didn't he? Why didn't she just regurgitate the sun at that point?
Because he wasn't done stewing. I guess the digestive system of this animal is very slow. And if they were to have cut it open, they would have found that little Kintner boy, too.
Brad, any thoughts on this whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit weird, but maybe it was the kind of thing, too, where the mama was holding on to it like for a meal later, and then when maybe heard them coming up and was like, no, I'm gonna hide this and then come back later.
Okay, so Paz jets into the air and the raptor grabs not only him but his son, and Paz fires a flamethrower at the raptor from his mouth, and Bo-Katan tries to save the boy from the creature's grip while the other Mandalorians are on jetpacks are there to distract. And I don't know, I felt like this whole sequence is kind of like an underwhelming action sequence with Paz Vizsla escaping and Mando knocking the boy from the raptor's grip and catching him in midair, and then the raptor falls into the water and it's eaten by a dinosaur. The dinosaur turtle is back, or another dinosaur turtle is back in. What did you guys think, Brad? What did you think of this whole action sequence?
It was enjoyable to an extent, but there was a part of it that felt a little clumsy, because at times it was difficult to really get a grasp on like what certain Mandalorians were doing, like how their shooting of their grapples was like affecting the raptor and whatnot. And I feel like there could have been a better way to really show how this confrontation was unfolding and what they were trying to do. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't, you know, I kind of liked the there's always a bigger fish, you know, kind of approach of having the raptor get eaten by the dinosaur turtle and whatnot. So it was good, but not great. Could have been better.
Yeah. The father and son are reunited and they return to the covert victorious. Bo-Katan is honored for the rescue and the armor replaces her lost shoulder armor with a signet featuring the Mythosaur, and Bo-Katan confides with the armor. Finally, she tells someone that she has seen the Mythosaur, and the armor is like, yeah, sure you did. We see many things. What are you guys' thoughts on this? Like, even though she insists that she actually saw the Mythosaur and it wasn't a vision, do you think the armor believes her at all?
I think that the armor kind of came around when she was insisting, which is why the last line of the episode is, this is the way. But I feel like the thing that was most interesting about it for me was that I felt like I'm really torn about what Bo is doing here. Is she testing the story out to see if people will believe it? Is she unsure of it because she doesn't believe it herself? I think that tension inside of Bo is really the most interesting emotional story going on with the Mandalorian stuff side of the story right now.
Yeah, for sure. And also they have brought three raptor babies back to the covert, which I guess let's jump into before we jump into speculation. Let's take a we're gonna take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Okay, let's jump into speculation. What are the Mandalorians going to do with the baby raptors? Brad, tell me.
I'm pretty sure that they are going to train them and teach them to talk and give them armor and make them foundlings.
Brian, do you have any better answer?
No, I think they're going to be, like, we saw a hint of what this was in Book of Boba Fett, right? Like, they've got mounts now. They're going to have those creatures and they're going to tame this planet.
Oh, so you think Mandalorian are going to be like riding these baby raptors?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Stuff? Yeah.
Which is, again, sort of another sort of nod to the holiday special.
Oh, for sure. Where is Kelleran Beck going to take Grogu?
Oh, somewhere fabulous, I hope. I would take a whole spinoff show of them doing the Lone Wolf and Cub thing. Like,
It'd be too samey, though. It'd be too samey.
No, because a Jedi on the run during the Empire is way different than Din Djarin.
But it's not much.
And a bounty hunter.
But it's not much different than Obi-Wan trying to save Princess Leia.
There's a lot. There's different baggage there, though.
I mean, thematically and characteristically, yes, that's true. But yeah. Like, I'm not sure how many stories we need of a Jedi trying to protect, you know, a young character.
But the Padawan is in danger, too, for the fact of their being a Jedi as well. I don't know. This is, like, I think my favorite untapped area, so I just want more stories like that. And Ahmed Best just really sold this in such a short amount of time. I just want more of him.
I mean, I like him, too. I'm wondering how much we're going to see more of Grogu's backstory, like how he got to that. I mean, obviously, in season one, we learned how he got... I'm thinking about Din now. I'm mixing things up. Like, how much more of this backstory do you think we're going to see from him getting from where we see him with Color and Beck to him being the bounty in season one episode or chapter one of The Mandalorian? Doesn't really matter at this point. Like, I feel like the only thing I really needed to know is how he got saved from Order 66.
I am still really curious about how he gets on the radar of the Advanced Science Division. I'm really curious about how he ends up in the hands of the Nikto traitors or pirates. I'm really curious to see how he stays safe with Kelleran Beck dead or however, you know, maybe Kelleran Beck is still out there. Who knows? But what that emotional, I think that would be a really emotional scene for us to see is whatever Kelleran Beck's sacrifice is for Grogu on the next step of his journey.
Yeah. I think with this Mandalorian group, they're definitely expanding this group a little, especially with adding Ragnar to the group. And now you have a father-son relationship. Brian, or actually either of you, what role do you think Ragnar is going to play in the series? Or do you think he's just going to be a background character from here on out?
I don't necessarily see him playing a bigger part than Paz Vizsla has.
I guess like one of the big questions I have, what were you going to say?
Maybe they train together. Maybe they do more of that Karate Kid style, you know, training against each other. But that would be the extent of it that I would imagine.
How will the covert change Bo-Katan? I feel like we already feel that she's kind of being accepted into this group. Maybe she's seeing like, oh, maybe this is where I'm meant to be. Any theories on where this is going to go? I eventually see that her and the armor are going to butt heads, right?
Only because they're trying to kiss.
While they're trying to have sex with their armor on. Okay,
yeah.
Brad, any thoughts on Bo-Katan's future as part of this group?
No, I think she's biding her time and still figuring things out. And, you know, I assume, you know, this is heading to a point where, like, these two different sides of Mandalorian culture come together. And I think, you know, we'll eventually see her leading all of them. But it's a matter of how she gets there and, you know, what steps that need to be taken to get there as well.
See, that's all the questions I wrote down for the speculation after this episode, because I feel like this episode doesn't point us in many directions of where this show's going. So I'll leave the floor open to you guys. Like, what do you guys think? What now? What's the next episode? Where are we headed?
I think the last episode actually is the bigger clue for that, right? You've got this group of Mandalorians who are regrowing their strength, and you have some unseen force of the Empire willing to try to eliminate them again, which is what we saw with Bo-Katan's castle. And I think the last episode really showed us that Moff Gideon was pulling some of those strings, but I think that Thrawn might be pulling some of his strings. So I think the next episode or the next few episodes are going to lead us down that trail to actually reintroduce Gideon and possibly show us that shadow of Thrawn.
What do you think, Brad?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where we likely need to be headed. I do wonder how soon we'll get back to it or what happens next, because there was no real indication here as to, like, you know, a next step or teasing, you know, what's to come. But the Moff Gideon sort of cliffhanger of it all, and the stuff with Dr. Pershing and Elia Kane was a pretty integral thing for us to focus on. So I feel like we have to get some kind of development there. And The Mandalorian has been pretty quick about churning out stories that we thought would take longer to deal with. So I do wonder if maybe that's where we'll head back to after this.
Do you think we're actually going to pay off the Mythosaur this season?
I think we kind of have to.
I think that's why the opening scene is a metaphor for that, right? The opening scene is a metaphor for the creature coming up out of the water. I think the last scene is going to be that too.
Okay, that brings us to the end of this episode. Do either of you have anything else to add before we go?
I'm just really grateful that Jar Jar Binks is finally getting his due. Not just the actor playing him, but clearly Jar Jar Binks had a hand in saving Grogu, and this pleases me greatly.
I hope you get to interview Dave Filoni and ask him that ridiculous question. And
I wouldn't ask him about something that is potentially in the future, because I know he's just going to give me a roundabout answer. I've talked to him enough to know that he's going to say something like, always in motion is the future, which is a waste of a question. But it's a solid theory, and I don't know how you could come up with anything else.
If you were going to spend your time asking Dave Filoni about anything, it would have to be the Mandalorian sex thing.
That would probably yield a much better answer.
Yeah.
I really wonder what Dave Filoni would answer. You know, you can actually go to ChatGPT and answer this question in the voice of Steve Jobs. I wonder if they could answer my question in the voice of Dave Filoni.
And would that give you an answer that is wearing a hat?
Probably. Okay, so you can find more of all the articles we mentioned on today's podcast on slashfilm.com. You can find this podcast, Slash Film Daily, on Apple, Google, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps. My dogs are barking because there's someone at the door. Please send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, speculation to peter@slashfilm.com. And please rate and read this podcast on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends, spread the word. We'll see you tomorrow.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.